A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I'll be talking to Raphael Baer about the Clegg Farage debate, Alex Clark will talk to Booker Prize winner Eleanor Catton, and I'll talk to Ian Steadman about hashtag activism. I'm joined by our political editor, Raphael Baer, to talk about, well, let's talk about the big issue of the week, which is, of course, Europe. We're recording this the night after Nigel Farage and Nick Clegg, or Nick Farage, as David Dimbleby put it, faced off again about Europe. This time the margin of between them was even bigger, right? I mean, it was an even more convincing win for Nigel Farage. Do you think that was a fair reflection of what happened in the debate?
And tonight, actually, I think it was, actually. After the first debate, my own personal view was that Nick Clegg had won the argument and had looked more sort of steady and competent and reasonable, whereas the UKIP leader had his slightly sort of foam-flecked, cantankerous side exposed. It didn't surprise me that after that first debate, opinion polls still backed Farage, just because public opinion is sort of viscerally hostile to the EU. A lot of people are pretty hostile to Nick Clegg, and so Farage had all the advantages of an outsider. I was even less surprised that the opinion polls went the same way last night and by quite a strong margin. I think actually
it was 68 in one poll, 69 in another, in favour of Farage, right?
Yes, well clear of 2/3 against the EU and against Clegg. I think that the two crucial elements for me were that Farage kept that slightly sort of mean-spirited and sort of borderline bonkers side of his character that you've sometimes seen recently in check. And he stayed focused on the issue in hand, which was, should Britain be a member of the European Union? Whereas Clegg tried something slightly different. Mm. He tried to chip away at the whole UKIP worldview. He tried to present Farage as speaking as a sort of being desperate to, he kept using this phrase, turn the clock back, talked about the sort of dangerous fantasy of what Britain would be like outside the EU and spoke of his love for modern Britain, which he sort of identified as this sort of tolerant, diverse, happier, more optimistic vision of what the country could be than the one that Farage was offering, which is probably the right line of attack, but it sort of came across as if he was saying, I don't like people who think the same things as Nigel Farage does, which is very different from saying I don't trust or like Nigel Farage. And that was dangerous. I think that was a mistake.
I thought Nick Clegg's biggest misstep came at the end when they said, well, what do you think the EU will look like in 10 years' time? And he went, basically the same. Because that's not an easy line to sell. And certainly not the one that Cameron would sell, where he kind of goes, you know, obviously I want huge renegotiation. I want lots of money and powers and all this sort of stuff back. And I think that's a much easier pro-EU case to sell rather than...
And that's an extension of the big problem that Clegg had last night was the same one that he had in the first debate, I think, which is he finds it very difficult, and a lot of pro-Europeans find it very difficult to respond to the charge that the reason you don't want a referendum is because you think stupid people will give the wrong answer. Because traditionally, that is exactly why pro-Europeans have not wanted a referendum. And they can find all sorts of elaborate ways of making that case, but it is... you know, people aren't stupid, and they can tell that when Farage says you don't want a referendum because you haven't got the guts because you think you'll lose, that there is an underlying fundamental truth in that. And until until pro-Europeans find a way to say, you know what, we're not scared, we believe in this thing and we can defend it, bring it on, they don't really get into the conversation about the referendum. And largely it is about the referendum. That's in policy terms is what this debate is really all about. So that the Clegg is always on the back foot in that conversation.
I thought my favourite tweet of the night came from Hugo Rifkin of the Times, where he said, "What? You know, how weird the world is when the kind of anti-establishment is a bloke called Nigel who worked for 20 years as a commodities broker." But he does that very well, doesn't he, Nigel Farage? He portrays himself as this kind of lone avenger against the establishment.
He does. I mean, there was the most extraordinary call at the end where he said, you know, he said, yeah, I invite the British people to rise up in my people's army and storm the establishment. Now, I mean, yeah, this is a guy who went to an expensive private school in London and, as you say, was a sort of commodities trader in the city. And his whole project is bankrolled by a very small number of largely ex-Tory donors, whose tax status I'd be fascinated to read about in more depth. No doubt it's all entirely fair and reasonable. But nonetheless, the point is that there is powerful money supporting a man who in every way looks and sounds like the traditional establishment, mobilising anti-establishment feeling. And so what has gone on here? It's extraordinary, really. I mean, part of it is that he speaks to a lot of people who would never have felt opposed to a certain kind of establishment 20 or 30 years ago, but feel expropriated, that the country has been taken away from them. We know from the polls that they're older, they've worked very hard, are now reaching retirement or are retired. And what they find, generally speaking, I don't want to make too gross a generalisation, is that they're nowhere near as well off as they thought they would be in retirement. They can't afford to put their feet up. Sometimes they can't afford to necessarily heat their houses through the winter. They certainly can't afford to do the things for their children and grandchildren that they imagined they would be able to do. And that is a feeling of shame and anger that something that you sort of assumed was your due has just been taken away from you. You factor in a sense of sort of encroaching decay from a cosmopolitan, metropolitan elite that likes foreignness and is relaxed about grime, and generally the sense that the sort of this encroaching decadence is coming to your door and no one is barring its way. And then along comes Nigel Farage and says, enough is enough, I'm the person to stop this. Now, and it's very resonant.
Did you take the populist poll, which segmented the population down into these seven different categories that they want to look at people in? It's well worth doing if you didn't. And it says that the largest group of people are people who are essentially just don't complain. That's basically, you know, get on with it, keep your head down, don't complain. But I was talking to someone in the lobby and he said almost everybody in the lobby fell into one of things. They were either cosmopolitan critics, which is basically sort of eats swan, lives in North London, or comfortable optimists, i.e. I'm doing all right, actually. I don't know why everyone's sort of banging on about this recession all the time. And I think that there is a general problem that you would not find very many of the rest of the population falling into those two segments. But all politicians probably fall into one. Almost all the journalists who write about politics fall into one of them. And that anti-politics feeling is incredibly strong. My question is, does it survive contact with electoral reality? When UKIP, for example, start making some gains in British, you know, council elections, well, English council elections probably most likely, you know, maybe if they get an MP after the next election, are they still going to be able to ride the anti-politics wave when they are politics?
Yeah, and this is a tension at the heart of the UKIP project, isn't it? That they want to be anti-establishment and they want to, as you see, for exactly the reasons you say, be confounding established views of what politics should be about. But actually, they also need to ape a degree of respectability and seriousness to get across those key electoral hurdles. And there's an interesting precedent here with the BNP, and I wouldn't want to stretch the comparison too far, but we know that UKIP have taken a lot of voters from the BNP. And Farage has actually said he's very proud to have done that because he, you know, in his argument, that means he's keeping the far right in check because he's a sort of respectable sort of populist, which is very different, apparently.
And at the same time, he's barred ex-BNP members from running for
UKIP. Because he understands that it's disreputable to vote BNP. And the success of UKIP, I think, is a lot of people who were potentially quite open to a BNP-type message, but understood that it was somehow indecent and disreputable. And Farage has very cleverly neutralised that. But what you found is that when they got councillors, the BNP and other similar, you know, sort of far right organisations, they've been useless, and people have chucked them out quite quickly. And it is, and certainly, what's interesting is that UKIP MEPs have been useless, and a couple of them have lost their posts because of fraud, and they have not been effective legislators. Now, in the European Parliament, that doesn't really matter because no one's paying attention. It would matter if it was an MP. And certainly there is a feeling and a hope in the Conservative side that people will express this UKIP-iness that they've got burning a hole in them in the European elections in May, that they will get that out of their system, but then in a general election where it really matters, they'll, as it were, come home to the Tories. And I've spoken to Conservative MPs who have said that they aren't even trying to canvass people for the European elections on the side of the Conservatives. They are quite explicitly saying, if you feel you have to get this off your chest, fine, do it in Europe. But for goodness sake, don't let Ed Miliband in through the back door. And just to finish the point, the interesting thing is the number of UKIP supporters who aren't susceptible to if you vote for UKIP, you end up with Ed Miliband as Prime Minister, because actually quite a lot of them say, I don't care, you're all the same. Ed Miliband, David Cameron, whatever, I just want to hurt you all. And if that survives all the way up until May 2015, then the Tories are in very serious trouble.
Well, that brings a larger point that's interesting, because actually last night's big win for Farage at the expense of Clegg is really good news for Labour for two reasons, which is that we know that those left-wing Lib Dem voters are very helpful to them, and we know that UKIP taking away Conservative votes are very helpful to them. How does Labour talk about the things that obviously animate a large section of the electorate without making them seem more important? I mean, I think immigration is the classic example that everybody, you know, you talk about immigration, therefore people feel it's a bigger issue, and it spirals into a...
Yeah, and you confirm the sort of the salience of it while not persuading people that you really actually have the power to do anything, that you really actually have the power to do anything about it. This is a massive problem for Labour. I was having a conversation with, I think what in journalistic terms you have to call a very senior figure in the Labour Party just yesterday, and I was relating my experience in Sale East and Withenshaw, where I was talking to young people about their concerns, and they were saying all the things that Ed Miliband has been talking about. They're talking about job insecurity, 0 hours contracts that mean they don't feel like earning any money even when they're working, the cuts to services that made them useless, the bedroom tax, cuts to disability living allowance, all this stuff. And it was basically just reciting the list of things that Ed Miliband talks about. And at the end of the conversation, they'd say, and so I'm voting UKIP. And this very senior figure in the Labour Party who I mentioned this to was sort of looking quite enthusiastic with the first bit of what I was saying. And he looked terribly crestfallen when then said, actually, and what they're doing is voting UKIP. They don't know how to connect. Labour don't know how to connect their articulation of the concerns that people have, which they know are real concerns, and they feel if they could get behind that, if you could say, we'll provide the houses, we'll sort out the services, we'll make sure wages keep up with everything, with prices, and then you would somehow neutralise the anti-immigration stuff, because people don't like immigrants because they think they're filling up the school places and taking away the houses. They're not actually all essentially racist. Some are racist, but not all. So Labour's understanding of how it might work, it seems perfectly plausible.
Saying that they're the solution to those
they
problems
don't have the strategy.
The bit that they haven't got to yet.
That's the bit that doesn't click into place.
Well, on that slightly, half optimistic note, I guess. Let's be, be optimistic ourselves about it. Thank you very much, Raf.
Thank you.
My name's Alex Clark, and I'm here at the Cambridge Literary Festival. I'm joined now by Eleanor Catton, who's come to talk about her book The Luminaries, which won the Man Booker Prize and which is just out in paperback. Hello, Eleanor, and thanks so much for joining us.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Just tell us a bit, now your book's coming out in paperback. Obviously, many people have read it in hardback, but I suspect even more will be thrilled to read the paperback. Just set the scene in a few words, if you can, for us, and tell us what it's about.
Sure. Well, I've been describing it for a long time as an astrological murder mystery. It's a story that's set on the gold rush, or on the goldfields, I should say, of New Zealand, the west coast of the South Island of New Zealand, in the middle 1860s. And one thing actually that the paperback has that the hardback did not have is an illustrated map. because so many people read the hardback and wrote in to my agent or my publisher and asked for a map to be included.
A map of New Zealand or a map of the heavens or is
no,
it both?
No, actually, a map of the goldfields of Hokitika with the kind of canvas town of Kenieri, which is a little bit inland, and kind of the site of all of the shipwrecks and cottages and various things that figure into the story. So it's kind of, yeah, it's a bit of a bonus in the paperback. Yeah, so I suppose, you know, briefly, the story is an adventure mystery and of a kind. It revolves around, revolves around the disappearance of a prospector in a town in 1866, and also the kind of the questionable death of one of the town's inhabitants. And so a lot of fortunes change hands and people blackmail one another and stab one another in the back and that kind of thing.
It's got this amazing beginning, hasn't it, with somebody arriving to make their fortune. You know, those words I know are very important, the idea of a self-made man and the idea of fortune, you know, as a kind of financial fortune and also sort of chance, fate. And Walter Moody arrives knowing nothing, and really he's our sort of initial kind of guide in a way. We know as little as he does. He arrives into the port, absolutely sort of sea legs, you know, going from under him, and is immediately aware that the hotel he's come to, something's going on.
Right. I think that in a lot of ways, a great deal of the Luminaries was influenced by children's literature for me. Children's literature is something I read as much as I can of. And where I take a lot of heart, I think, as a writer, and returning to the books that I loved as a child. And one thing that is very, very useful to any children's writer, or also any genre writer, I think, is beginning by having somebody be a stranger in a situation, or kind of enter into a situation that they're unfamiliar with, just because you can then, in telling that character the story, inadvertently also tell the reader the story, you know, and it kind of makes your job a little bit easier. So I knew from the very beginning when I was writing the book that I wanted to begin with a stranger arriving in town. It's something I notice a lot in HBO dramas as well. It nearly always begins with a stranger, you know, something like Twin Peaks or Deadwood, you know. The stranger coming to town is such a classic beginning of an adventure story, because it's kind of a double revelation, you know, the town has to incorporate that stranger and also the stranger has to kind of discover the town.
And there's also this kind of fantastic element of, you know, influence of sort of Victorian sensation novels, and I mean, I was put in mind when I read it immediately of that kind of atmosphere of Wilkie Collins, where you have, you know, the kind of the world coming together, travellers, people from other parts of the world, that sense of a kind of things springing up, mysteries, all that sort of thing. And I think you were reading quite a lot of that fiction in the sort of in the kind of planning stages, weren't you?
Yeah. No, I love reading mysteries. You know, I think that one of the great pleasures of a mystery is the knowledge that the writer has done so much more work than you have to as the reader. You know, they've kind of in their ingenuity in laying down the plot, they've apprentice themselves to your surprise as a reader, that they've kind of laid down the plot with your surprise in mind, and I'd always loved that as a reader, so I wanted to kind of set myself the challenge of trying to do that as a writer as well. And the Gold Rush scenario actually it presented itself to me as a kind of a fine theatre in which to play out a mystery story, partly because this is 1866.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
that this gold rush in New Zealand happened. And so that's a full, you know, 17 years after the gold rush in California first began. And what I discovered when I started reading up about the era was that the legislators of the goldfields in New Zealand had had quite a lot of time to learn from the mistakes made on other goldfields. So not only California, but also Victoria in Australia, and then Otago down south in New Zealand, which happened about 1861. And for that reason, nearly all of the crimes that were kind of afoot, so to speak, on the goldfield weren't what we would call blue-collar crimes. They were what we would call white-collar crimes. So, you know, fraud and blackmail and people reneging on contracts and that kind of thing. And so I found when I started doing the research that there was a lot of fodder for mystery. It wasn't people weren't kind of turning up in town and, you know, firing off a round of bullets and kind of murdering one another and walking out without consequence. It was much more subtle than that and much more scheming than that.
Let's do that thing now and drop the A-bomb, as I think you call it. A lot has been made in this book of its length, also of its very intricate patterning, which owes a lot to astrology, the A-bomb. Mm-hmm. Just tell us a little bit, I'm using your kind of nickname for it, just tell us a bit about that sort of patterning. I mean, it starts with the title, doesn't it, with the luminaries.
That's true, yeah. The luminaries is an astrological term that refers to the sun and the moon together. All of the planets in astrology can be understood as possessing a kind of influence upon the human spirit or the human psyche. And the sun and the moon, when understood together, form the ego, kind of roughly, with the sun being the kind of external or visible version of that ego or dimension of that ego, and then the moon being everything that's kind of hidden as a counterweight behind what is visible. The way that astrology works in the book is that every single one of the characters is modeled on an astrological archetype. So there are 12 characters who are each one of the signs of the zodiac. They each represent one of the signs of the zodiac, and then 7 characters who each represent one of the planets. And lastly, a kind of a terrestrial character who's the fixed point around which everything else moves. And in the emotions throughout the book, I've patterned the plot of the book, I guess, on actual horoscopes from the era, which I generated using computer software. So although the book is not, you know, a historical novel in some senses, I've taken a lot of liberties with history and bent some historical facts to kind of suit my purposes. The book is historically accurate to the sky.
just tell us a bit about what it felt like. You finally finished this immense novel, huge amount of work, and then for it to be recognised, I mean, so internationally, for it to win the Man Booker Prize. Tell us a bit about what that was like and what it's meant for you as a writer.
Oh, I never dreamed that anything like this would have happened. You know, I think that the challenge of writing the book was so immense for me. It's by far the hardest thing that I've ever done in my life. I feel like it's the most personal achievement. You know, I was so exhilarated when I finally finished the book, and I've you know, that this very complicated structure, I got to work in the way that I wanted to make it work, and found my way out of all these holes that I'd kind of dug for myself and corners that I'd painted myself into. That I think that everything else, I mean, although it's been astonishing, is not as personal an achievement for me as just the one that I felt on the day after I finished the book, you know, and sent it off to my editor at long last. Which is, I mean, I don't want that to sound ungrateful in any way, but one of the funny things about prizes is that they happen so long after the fact, you know, after the fact of you finishing the book and kind of giving birth to it, as it were, and they're so accidental, you know. I mean, they depend so much on who the jury is and who else writes books that year and what mood everybody's in and, you know, what's happening in the real world as well and how your novel speaks to that or doesn't speak to that. And so I think that you need to kind of keep in a lot of ways, a bit of a healthy distance from that and kind of understand how incredibly circumstantial it is and conditional it is. Whereas what really matters is writing the book that you want to write.
And now writing the next book.
Hopefully. I am not writing at the moment. I haven't written fiction for over a year. And I don't miss it, actually. I am still reading, and I think that if I were ever to be in a space where I wasn't reading, I'd feel very unhappy. But I really don't mind not writing, you know.
I think your readers might have something to say about that, but we certainly think you kind of you obviously have deserved a break, but we hope you'll come back to it, and we hope you'll come back to the UK as well. Thank you.
I hope that too.
Thank you so much, Eleanor.
Cheers.
This week in the New Statesman magazine, we have a special tech issue where we talk to Jimmy Wales about Turkey's Twitter ban and net neutrality. We have pieces from Syria, from Australia. Laurie Penny has visited San Francisco. And I'm joined today by Ian Steadman, our tech reporter, to talk a little bit about some of the issues that it raised. First of which, Ian, is there's been a lot of discussion recently. There was a big controversy over the American satirical show, The Colbert Report, where a joke was taken out of context and tweeted. It was perceived to be racist, and then a hashtag was started immediately that went straight to sort of DEFCON 5 of cancel Colbert. The fallout from that has been, I think, absolutely fascinating. It's shown up some of the strengths of hashtag activism and some of the pitfalls as well. How much do you think now you can say with a straight face that social media changes the world?
I think you can. My viewpoint on this is the first fundamental thing that I think when it... I find the use of the term hashtag activism is usually used in a derogatory sense, and I find that a little bit harsh simply because it rests on this idea of a dichotomy between the internet and real life, which I think is false. Because if that was the case, then why do things like trolling matter or death threats matter? I mean, the internet is just as much a part of real life. It's just a different way we express and communicate with each other. Leading on from that is the fact that it allows new context to be formed, like jokes being taken out of context. I know we have different views on the cancel Colbert thing, but I think both of us agree.
Have different views in a way, because I think first sort of start. So the activist involved with that was a woman called Sui Park, who's Asian American. She's done some really interesting things before. She did a hashtag called Not Your Asian Sidekick,
which was
really interesting. But I mean, it was old fashioned feminist consciousness raising. I mean, it's something that, you know, anyone who's involved in activism, one of your first duties is to identify a problem and convince other people that it is a problem.
Absolutely.
And that she did that extremely effectively.
I think that's something that Twitter is really, really good at, which is, I mean, it's easy to dismiss people tweeting things like I'm not your Asian sidekick as just like an echo chamber. But in a way, it is good that the internet allows marginalized communities who haven't been able to talk to each other or find each other because, you know, they're the only person they know in real life. But on the internet, they're not. And they can kind of share experiences and go, wait, I'm not alone in this.
You definitely see that with something like the way that atheism is such a huge deal online. And I think that when we did the Richard Dawkins guest edit, you had lots of people buying a single copy of that and having it sent to kind of, you know, Minnesota and something like that.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, a lot of these people are probably living in a town that where a lot of your social life is organized around church. That's probably how you meet people. That's, you know, something that is woven into the fabric of your community. And it becomes extra hard in that situation to say, I don't believe in all this. I want to exit this. And therefore, you've seen creations like Reddit's atheism thread, which I know has its issues because it's a bit bro dude, but where people who would have otherwise felt very much like the only atheist in the village
have kind
of come together.
There is, unfortunately, though, the other side of that where the openness that allows that kind of community to form is also the kind of openness that allows any group to take control of something or to change. Thinking this morning, did you see the normalized nudity hashtag?
I did.
I saw that starting last night, which was a bunch of women posting topless photos of themselves to kind of say, like, look, being nude is not necessarily a sexualized thing, as one of these kind of feminist kind of discussions. this morning it was, I saw it again, people talking about how, like, last night while I was asleep,
4chan got hold of it.
Yeah, this is, and what it was full of pictures of, like,
so for readers who are, like, or listeners who are lucky enough not to know what 4chan is, the B-board, which is, it's one of its random image board, where you just post an image and then people can reply to that, was once described as the asshole of the internet.
Oh, it is.
Which, yeah, I think is a really fair description of it. So that tag is now filled with people's exploded legs and granny porn and...
Yeah. Lots of penises. Huge number of penises.
That is the internet.
Yeah.
But for me, that was a very nice example of the fact that, you know, the internet, this is why we can't have nice things, because, yeah, you know, even if you disagree, yeah, with what people were trying to do there, I think the normal human response is, well, you know, it's not for me, but, you know, yeah, fill your boots, rather than, which is, I don't, yeah, like this, so I'm going to ruin it for everybody, and, yeah, no one else can have any fun that I don't like, which is what I felt that, you know,
yeah, and that unfortunately does happen a lot on the internet, is the, you're not allowed to have fun.
You're not allowed, yeah, in the prescribed way.
Yeah.
But I thought that both of those situations are interesting, because I think particularly in the Cancel Colbert one, there is a really interesting interplay that Stephen Colbert himself referenced when he came back to it on his show about how many articles the mainstream media had got out of this.
Yeah.
And I think that what Sui Park said, which I thought was really interesting, was that she went straight to Cancel Colbert rather than, you know, let's have an interesting nuanced discussion about what this joke might mean.
Yeah.
Was that gets attention. And and she's had a lot of attention for this. She's had a lot of negative attention.
A massive amount of abuse.
Huge amounts of abuse and death threats and rape, yeah, threats and all the things that you get as a woman speaking up on the internet.
Yeah.
And there's a tough thing of saying, well, if you had approached this in a slightly more nuanced, less aggressive way, would the response been less aggressive?
In a way, is there not a kind of irony here, in the sense that there has been this long-running kind of bubbling under criticism of Colbert, the kind of idea that just because you're repeating a racist joke knowingly doesn't stop it being a racist joke. That kind of criticism.
Well, no, but that's been a huge in criticms of Ricky Gervais as well,
yeah,
and his
absolutely
use of the word Hmong. And the idea is that, and actually it's the same kind of thing that drove the criticism of Lily Allen's recent music video,
yeah,
which is when you are repeating racist stereotypes with an ironic glaze.
Yeah.
How much of your audience is appreciating a ironic glaze? How much of them are just appreciating being able to look at stuff that is now seen as taboo, yeah,
and
but not feel guilty?
If you can't control the context of it, those things can go wrong. And the same thing with the hashtag, which is, you know, she goes straight into the criticism, but that's because she comes from a community where that kind of criticism is an established thing. But as soon as it goes beyond that, it becomes out of context itself. And then you get these other kind of layers happening and it becomes, yeah.
Well, this is the book that I'm writing about for next week's magazine. It's by Dana Boyd, who's a social media theorist, called It's Complicated, which is the social lives of networked teens. And she has an interesting theory that's called context collapse. Mm. And she applies it in the sense of teenagers talking to each other on their Twitter feeds or Instagram pictures. She has the example of a kid who writes a college application letter saying he comes from a inner city black neighborhood, he's been involved with gangs, he wants to get out and go to this elite university. The university then go and look at his MySpace page, because this is 2007, and see it's full of gang signs.
Yeah.
And they think, well, hang on, was he lying to us? And she says to them, well, look, you have to understand that young people navigate different contexts, and people... The idea we have of the self being consistent across a lot of different contexts is a fiction. And what social media does is exposes that fiction. The way that you talk to your family, the way that you talk to your friends, the way you talk to a potential employer,
yeah,
are all very different. And one of the problems we have is context collapse. So we can't deal with the idea that something that is appropriate in one forum now gets completely taken out of,
yeah,
context.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably a useful theory. I'm not sure what the answer to it is.
Yeah. It reminds me of the thing a couple of weeks ago with BuzzFeed and quoting tweets of women revealing what they were posting, what they were wearing the first time they were sexually assaulted.
Yeah.
And BuzzFeed quoted a lot of those tweets in an article without asking permission, which...
Well, then Hamilton Nolan at Gawker wrote a piece entitled Twitter is Public.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, for journalists, that's a huge ethical dilemma, because you... Technically it is, and if you embed a tweet in,
yeah,
your webpage, Twitter still owns that content. You're not breaking any laws.
Mm.
But in the same way that you would ask if you had a source who was very mentally fragile,
yeah,
what effect is running this story going to have on them?
The way I look at that kind of thing, and things like Twitter, is that it's a similar kind of thing. Imagine if you were in a crowded bar talking loudly with your mates and you overheard someone say something quite controversial. It's that similar kind of thing of, like, yes, it's public. You might have the right to quote it, but it doesn't mean it's the nice or correct or polite or morally good thing to do.
Again, is an example of context collapse. Yeah. People posted those things with the assumption that they would be retweeted. Some of them gave permission for it to be retweeted by the person who started that hashtag. They didn't post them with the assumption that they would end up forever on BuzzFeed. And that, again, comes to, I know Sophie Wilkinson, who you know, wrote a piece yesterday about public eating and this weird Facebook group that likes to post photos of women eating in public.
Yeah, she was eating on the tube. She was really hungover. She was eating on the tube and some guy took a photo of her in a very unflattering position while stuffing her face with a kebab or something. And it was posted on this Facebook group and got thousands of comments for people slagging off her ginger hair and stuff like that. And all the kinds of horrible things that happen in those groups. And eventually she managed to get Facebook to take it down because it's harassment. But the guy who did it didn't consider it to be harassment because it's like, it's just a bit of fun. You're in public on the tube. You're doing this. Kind of the right to do it.
But it's, and I love the fact that he didn't at any moment seem to consider that there was something a bit weird about
the
Facebook group devoted to pictures of women eating.
No, that is in itself the weird thing. That's a normal thing now, a Facebook group dedicated to that.
But that's another example of context collapse, because obviously people eat in public. And actually, I'm a bit against people eating on the tube. But, you know, sometimes you're running late, you need to have a sandwich. You know, who am I to throw the first Instagram?
We've all done it.
But it's something that then I think Sophie experiences as kind of quite violating, because it's you in an unguarded moment.
Mm.
Anyway, I'm going to stop because otherwise we're going to end up rambling about every weird internet craze that there is. But come back, persuade me of the merits of hashtag activism.
I think it can be a good starting point, to put succinctly. I think it can be a good starting point, but obviously it's not going to be the end point in itself. I mean, it's no better than a petition, but it can be the start of something good.
Mm. And that's kind of echoes what our leader says this week, actually, which is about, and what you will hear from very senior figures in politics about digital campaigning. They think it's absolutely fantastic as an entry point to getting the email address of people, getting people involved in door knocking, which is still, you know, the thing that was most likely to sway your vote is, has someone been around? Have they delivered a leaflet? Have you visited your constituency surgery?
Yeah.
So it's probably about recognising that the stuff that it's very good for as a gateway, but also that it's not an end point.
It's an added tool rather than a replacement for what already existed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good. We're in agreement. We're in soggy consensus.
High five.
Thanks very much, Ian. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast. It's produced by Philip Morn, and our theme tune is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.